You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. We hear he is a wizard of wiz, if ever a wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the Land of Oz. This is the 12th edition of The Wizards of Money, and it is entitled The Imperial Budget and the Mythical Lockbox. We're going to take a look at the biggest budget in the whole wide world, in the whole of history. That is the $2 trillion US dollar budget of the US government. How does such a big empire spend the money it collects from its residents? And in such a big and complex budget, is there any misleading accounting wizardry going on? We will look at these and other questions by comparing the budget of the US government to that of its 2,000-year-old ancestor, the Roman government, in the early years of the Roman Empire. Then we will look at the role of the US Treasury in managing the biggest budget in the world. Finally, we'll spend some time dispelling the greatest treasury myth ever yet conceived of in the history of imperial budgeting. That myth involving the so-called Social Security and Medicare lockboxes. We will see that these lockboxes or safety trusts do not, and indeed logically cannot, exist by going back to a first principles understanding of what our money is. We will also discuss how the presentation of these mythical trusts by various spin doctors has seriously distorted the public's understanding of the funding for old age pension, medical and disability benefits. This has prevented productive debate and problem solving on what could prove to be the very thing that could bring down the great empire. That is, getting old. But first let's get started with what taxes are and what a government budget is, and then talk about how the money we use relates directly to our taxation system. Of course, one cannot talk about the role of tax without talking about the role of government, since tax is what funds everything a government decides to do. Regardless of what kind of society you live in, whether you live in a dictatorship, communist country, capitalist, democracy, or semi-democracy, a government will spend money on the following items in various orders of priority. Of course, there will be military expenditures for self-defense of the home country and possibly for control over other countries. There will be some type of system of law and order in the home country. There will be spending on infrastructure for economic development. There will be spending on human development, such as education, healthcare, and so forth. There will be spending on foreign relations with other countries. And they'll be spending on redistribution and economic insurance or some kind of safety net for individual residents. In the US, the main redistribution function and associated safety nets look a bit more like a type of insurance against personal economic disasters, whereby the risks of such events are spread across the society as a whole. For example, the risk of no longer having access to money due to retirement or disability, which is what Social Security covers, are borne by society as a whole, which has a much larger capacity to bear that risk than do the individuals likely to experience such events. As we saw in Wizards Part 10, the drastic consequences of placing these risks on individuals to bear became intolerable during the Great Depression, leading to the establishment of the Social Security system in the first place. The purpose of any insurance is to pool risks so that each individual in the pool lowers their own risk of some crippling disaster for a small annual fee paid to the pool. Therefore, any insurance mechanism is necessarily redistributive, Insurance, like federal taxes such as Social Security, are more redistributive than any private sector insurance because those with the highest ability to bear the related risks, which are those with high incomes, do get the lowest expected return on their contributions to the system. In addition, what is really happening with Social Security and with Medicare, as we shall see in the last section of this episode of Wizards, is that current workers' contributions are always paying for current retirees in the system, and there really isn't any saving for the future going on, as is so often presented to the public. Such a progressive risk-sharing mechanism could not work in the private sector, which is why it was founded as a public system in the first place. Normally, the largest and most debated government spending items in any country at any time are related to either military spending, social spending, and interest on government debt. We discuss these three areas of spending later on when we compare the Roman Empire's budget to that of the modern empire. But first we discuss the very much forgotten, ignored, and quite taken for granted relationship between money and tax. Most residents of any country will be charged taxes by their government on any income they make in their private activities. Tax is the most common liability all people must meet, and therefore people like to earn all or some of their income and accept payments in a medium of exchange or form of money that can be used to meet tax liabilities. It is also in the government's best interest that people get paid in a medium of exchange that it accepts for tax payments. It is also in banks' best interest that checks drawn on bank deposits are suitable to the state as a form of payment to meet tax liabilities. Therefore, to the extent that people are agreeable to a system of government taxation, everyone's best interests are served by a significant proportion of money in circulation being that which is acceptable to the state to meet tax liabilities. This is one of the main reasons why our major medium of exchange today, the US dollar, is created through what is really a joint venture between the Treasury Department of the US government and the private banking industry through their bank deposits and the Federal Reserve's role in creating what we call high-powered money that we spoke about in Wizards Part 1. Federal Reserve notes created by the Federal Reserve System and blessed by the US Treasury as being legal tender for all debts public and private can be used to pay taxes, but most people use drawings on bank balances to pay tax bills instead. The state, through its role in issuing banking licenses, regulating banks, and being the ultimate risk bearer in the case of bank failure, blesses payments using bank-created money or deposits, which are, after all, just electronic records, as being good and well for meeting tax liabilities. Recall that we spoke about the creation of both Federal Reserve notes and bank-created money, which is most money, in Wizards Part 1. The mature development of this system of state-blessed, bank-created money really came about with the founding of the Federal Reserve System in 1913 and the reintroduction of federal income tax in this very same year. These events both played a significant role in financing America's involvement in World War I. Today's US dollar monetary system and the links between the state and the private banking industry were further strengthened by state action such as federal depository insurance after various learning experiences such as the 29 crash and the Great Depression, as we spoke about in Wizards Part 10. Today, many years later, we don't think about these interesting ties between what the state accepts as payments for taxes, the money that banks create, and the money that we get paid in for our work. Instead, many of us just take it for granted that all this money is all the same stuff. But it took many years of learning from financial collapses to get money to its present state, and indeed, part of money, success, and stability is the fact that most people never stop to think about these things. So stable, so unquestioned, and so unchallenged is the US dollar system today that the US dollar and promises to pay US dollars in the future by the US Treasury are without a doubt the safest of all financial assets in the world. Hence, the US dollar and US Treasury bonds, which are promises by the US government to pay US dollars in the future, are known as risk-free set of financial assets. Risks of all other financial assets are higher and are measured against this risk-free benchmark. Of course, there are some risks of the US dollar and US treasuries. Basically, the risk is that one day the US could fall off the empire throne and the US dollar would collapse in value, but there is no expectation of this in the market, so the US dollar retains its and US treasuries retain their so-called risk-free status. When you think about saving for future retirement, it is this status of the US dollar that is critical to thinking about funding Social Security and Medicare. The understanding of state-sanctioned, bank-created money at such a fundamental level lies at the heart of the Social Security and Medicare debate, and it helps us understand the reasons that a publicly funded US pension system cannot be pre-funded by an investment trust in financial securities. This basic understanding of money is achievable for anyone, whether you've studied finance theory or not. We'll come back to these points in the last segment of this episode, but please keep them in mind throughout the discussion of state spending. Now, let's see how the US government's 21st century spending stacks up against the Roman Empire's 1st and 2nd century spending. Understanding 21st century imperial budgeting, there appears to be at least as many permutations and combinations available for presenting the US federal budget and US government spending as there are years that it would take you to count to $2 trillion, which is about 60,000 years. Note that the number 1 trillion is 1 million times by 1 million, or, if you prefer, 10 to the power of 12. How you would like to present the federal budget depends entirely on the bias you start with and the point you are trying to make. Therefore, it was decided in this episode of Wizards to admit the bias up front, and then you can better decide what to do with the data. The bias here in looking at US federal spending was the thought that maybe we just might be the Roman Empire woken up from a 1500-year nap after thoroughly exhausting ourselves last time. To be sure, the Roman Empire had many similarities with the modern US Empire, both being empires built on a combination of clever legal systems, hard work, confidence, much brutality in military conquest, and extensive use of slave labour, coupled with a system of desirable, tempting, and free entertainment to warm the masses to the empire, as well as erratic spouts of helpful assistance to the poor. Certainly also a widespread Roman currency and trade system and an extensive taxation and government spending program were just as critical to the success of the Roman Empire as they are to today's American Empire. We spoke of many of these parallels between the two empires in Wizards Part 4. The comparison of imperial budgets started with finding a Roman budget at a time around when their leaders stopped being elected and instead were appointed, and when ancestral lines of emperors became very popular. So I started with the early empire days of the 1st to 2nd centuries AD. A rather technical history book called Money and Government in the Roman Empire by Richard Duncan Jones, published by Cambridge University Press in 1994, explains an approach based on historical data from those days to calculating the Roman budget in this period. And this budget appears in the chapter of this book called The Imperial Budget. The total Roman budget in 150 AD was about 100 million sesterces, which was a common Roman currency that started in the BC years as about a quarter of the famous moneta denarius that we spoke about in Wizards Part 4. I was able to get estimates for the Roman budget in 150 AD broken down into the following expenditure categories. The first expense item is, of course, the largest one. It's the military expenditure item, and it made up about 70%, so almost three quarters, of the Roman budget. The next largest expenditures were, first of all, civil service, covering the judicial system, the police system, and various other government departments and employees, which made up another 10% of the budget. There was another item that was a catch-all, but was mostly made up of foreign affairs expenditure, which meant primarily paying off neighbours to behave well with respect to the Roman Empire. This costs about 10% of the imperial budget. Finally, the two smaller expenditures are social spending, which took up about 5% of the Roman budget, and the development of economic infrastructure, such as the road network and, of course, all the Colosseum building and things like that, which was another 5% of the Roman budget in this particular period, although at other periods it was much higher. I then compared this budget breakdown of the Roman Empire to the US actual government spending in the year 2001. The total spending in this year was $1.9 trillion. I did this comparison of the US data to the Roman data by first subtracting from the US data both Social Security and Medicare, which totaled about $0.6 trillion, because they have been more than fully self-funded by separate taxes known as the FICA taxes since the early 1980s. I also subtracted interest on public debt, which is about $0.2 trillion or $200 billion, for comparison purposes, since the Roman Empire really didn't have a consistent, well-developed system of sovereign debt issuance like the modern American Empire does. Some other adjustments I made to US imperial spending were to include veterans benefits, military retiree benefits, and military assistance to the provinces, or actually countries today, of Judea and Egypt in Roman times, or Israel and Egypt in modern times, and I put that military assistance with military spending. The inclusion of benefits to ex-military employees is consistent with the way the Roman data was derived, and the inclusion of military aid to Israel and Egypt was done because these were the two most expensive outer provinces to maintain under both empires. I came up with the following distribution of expenses on a comparable basis derived from Table 26.2 of the full current budget of the US government, which is conveniently available in spreadsheet form by going to the website of the Office of Management and Budget, which is located at www.whitehouse.gov/OMB. Then you click on the budget link and go to Spreadsheets, and then click on the Detailed Functional Tables, Chapter 26, if you want to see where this data comes from. If you want to see how I then categorize this data to be consistent with the Roman imperial budget, I will post that on the Wizards of Money website, which is located at www.wizardsofmoney.org. The modern imperial budget is broken down as follows. Again, like Rome, military makes up the largest expenditure item in the budget, at 40% of the US imperial budget. The next item, unlike Rome, is social spending, which makes up 30% of the imperial budget. And remember, this is excluding Social Security and Medicare, which we'll get to later. This social spending is primarily the means-tested social spending, such as Medicaid, food stamps, the TAMF benefits or temporary assistance for needy families, unemployment insurance, housing assistance and other supplemental income. Next is civil service spending, which means running the offices such as the justice system, Department of Treasury, benefits for federal civil retirees, and that amounts to about 10% of the imperial budget. Next is the spending on physical and economic infrastructure, which is also 10% of the imperial budget. And finally, there's an other catch-all category, which includes primarily education and training, some research, and then the rest of foreign affairs expenditure, apart from Israel and Egypt, which is included in military. In comparing the two budgets, the current US budget has more regular proportions of social spending. However, it should be noted that the US budget looked much more Romanesque in the early decades of last century, notably during the 40s for World War II, and during the 50s in gearing up for the Cold War, where in these eras military expenditures were close to and sometimes even exceeded the Roman proportion, which was 70%. The move from a Romanesque budget of the 40s and 50s to the current US spending distribution has a lot to do with increased healthcare expenditures such as Medicaid and the introduction of things like the Earned Income Tax Credit and changes to unemployment, housing and food assistance programs. Note that most of these social spending items included in the 30% of the US budget fall under the grouping of means-tested entitlements, which means that they make up the social safety net for people whose income and assets fall below a certain threshold. The other primary social spending benefits or social safety net items, which are not included in the data presented here, are Social Security and Medicare, which apply to retired and disabled persons and are not means-tested. As noted earlier, these benefits have been excluded from the distribution presented earlier because they have been self-funded through separate employer and employee contributions, known as the FICA taxes, for the past two decades. Because of the unique circumstances and confused public debate surrounding Social Security and Medicare, the last section of this episode of Wizards is devoted entirely to them. In general, rising medical costs affect both Medicare and the means-tested healthcare entitlements such as Medicaid. In fact, one of the historic data tables in the budget, which is Table 16.1 in case you're interested, shows total government spending on all health programs to have increased from about 2% of the imperial budget in 1962 to just over 10% by 1980 to almost 25% or one quarter of the imperial budget by the year 2001. As anyone with a health insurance policy will know, healthcare costs under private sector coverage also continue to rise. Overall, an increasing amount of America's total gross domestic product, or GDP, which is a measure of the total economy, is spent on healthcare. To keep score of the size of an economy and the size of national income, people often talk about GDP, or gross domestic product. This measure of national income is also equivalent to annual consumption expenditure, plus government spending, plus investment. And these are the only three things that can happen to your income. That means any income you get either goes to taxes, you spend it, or you save or invest it. US GDP, or gross domestic product, is about $10 trillion US dollars. Private consumption expenditure is about 65% of GDP. Government spending makes up about 20% of GDP, or $2 trillion a year. Today, healthcare expenditure makes up about 14% of US GDP. About 30% of this is picked up in government spending, and the rest is in private spending. By the end of this decade, healthcare spending will be inching very close to almost one-fifth of the total imperial GDP. America spends more on healthcare as a percent of GDP than any other developed nation, but it has less public coverage for this cost and, of course, a large uninsured population. So the high spending on healthcare in the US must be explained by something other than a general concern that everyone have adequate care. To a very large extent, the high level of American healthcare spending is a result of America becoming victim of its own technological success, its sedentary lifestyle, and a culture obsessed with longevity, overcoming natural cycles, and the desire to stay young. The latter appears to be common to inhabitants of many great empires of the past. This cultural obsession, fed by medical technologies far superior to any other country, may one day suck up so much of the US economy that it won't be able to sustain empire status. Indeed, it is perhaps the very fear of this that is really driving the attempts to redefine Social Security and Medicare that we shall talk about later. Moving on to some of these other expense items, we already noted that other spending included foreign affairs expenditure, other than the expenses of maintaining the outer provinces of Israel and Egypt, which are included in the military item. Under both empires, so-called foreign aid is or was an important part of keeping peace with peripheral provinces or countries. Unlike Rome, the US Empire also successfully uses loans through various multilateral institutions such as the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, International Development Bank, to maintain optimal relations with peripheral sovereigns. This use of loans gets to one of the fundamental differences between Rome and America, the role and leverage of the empire's financial system. Recall that we discussed the role of leverage in our modern financial system in Wizards Part 11, and its part in driving both the industrial and technological revolutions. The US Empire's success is largely due to the success and complete faith in its highly leveraged and purely fiat monetary system. Fiat money is money that has no storage or intrinsic value. In contrast, the Roman Empire's monetary system was almost entirely metal-based, and while there was easy access to credit for the ruling classes, this was not true for other classes. There appears to be much debate among historians about what stopped the Roman Empire from having an industrial revolution. But whatever one's opinion, surely a prerequisite is a highly leveraged and maybe purely fiat monetary system with sophisticated, widespread access to credit. But Rome never got to such a sophistication with its financial system. This provides us with another reason why its success was always more driven by military conquest than anything else. In contrast, for the modern American empire, financial influence is on a par with military power, and both feed off each other. The financial success of the American empire has also made its tax collection process far more efficient than any previous empire, the biggest problem being with collecting from the rich. Since the financial system is a fiat system, financial transactions can be purely electronic, and thus tax payment happens before many of us even get our monthly or fortnightly pay. Contrast this with the resource-intensive system of the old Roman tax collectors having to go door to door to collect weighty coins and various goods such as wheat grains. Now let's talk about imperial financial management. The role of the Treasury Department or Treasurer of any body is to deal with financial issues, to collect income, to disperse expenditures, to maintain the books, to see to the investment of surpluses and the borrowing necessary to cover shortfalls. And so too with the US Department of Treasury, that oversees the management of the biggest account in the world, that of the US government. The US Treasury Department oversees the revenue collector, the IRS, or Internal Revenue Service. It also oversees the Bureau of Public Debt that manages government debt issuance, and the US Financial Management Service, who manages the Imperial Books. It is important to appreciate that the accounts of a government do not look at all like the accounts of any body or person in the private sector, be it a for-profit or non-profit institution or even an individual. Indeed, if you viewed the US government balance sheet through a private sector lens, you would immediately declare it bankrupt and wonder why US government bonds are considered the safest asset in the world. However, the reason a government's balance sheet doesn't tell you what you need to know about the safety of a government obligation is because it doesn't place a value on the right of a sovereign to tax its residents. The right of the sovereign, held only by the sovereign, generally makes obligations of the sovereign a safer investment than any private sector body licensed by or domiciled in that same sovereign nation. Then, the higher the national income or the tax base in that country, the higher the expected revenue of the sovereign body, and the more likely it will be able to meet its own obligations, provided that its debt levels stay within certain bounds. Thus, it comes as no surprise that the country with the largest economy and national income also issues the least risky type of debt security. And in today's world, that is the US government. The resulting easy ability for the government to both tax its residents and to borrow facilitates the type of military expenditure and infrastructure necessary for empire building, maintenance, and for further economic growth. Economic growth spurs further access to capital for military and infrastructure expansion, and so the cycle of empire maintenance and building continues. Any empire would then be very concerned about the following two primary threats to this pattern of growth. Threat number one is growing expenditures that increasingly take money away from the primary empire building and maintenance expenditures, which are military and economic infrastructure investment. Threat number two is emerging empires with fast economic growth that could one day take your place. And so it would be that some of the main concerns of imperial financial management today are, in the first category of competition for empire building funds, are two things. One is terrorist actions that make economic infrastructure more expensive to maintain. The other is the aging of the US population and increasing healthcare costs. In the second threat area of emerging empires, the main concern would be the country of China. In this episode of Wizards, we are focusing on the demands on the imperial budget coming from the aging of the population and society's increasing medical expenses. If you have a regular job and you look at your pay stub, you will see two deductions for FICA taxes. FICA stands for Federal Insurance Contributions Act, and it covers two basic benefits for retirees and disabled persons. The first is Social Security. This is labelled as FICA OASDI, or Old Age and Survivors Insurance and Disability Insurance. This provides pension benefits to retirees, survivors, and disabled persons. The second is Medicare, labelled as FICA HI, or health insurance. This provides medical insurance for retirees, survivors, and disabled persons. Many people may be aware that the amount of money the government collects from us and our employers as the FICA taxes has exceeded the government's obligations in Social Security and Medicare payments for the past few decades. This has been true since the FICA taxes were increased under the Reagan administration in 1983, curiously, at a time when other federal income taxes were reduced. Then the question is, what has the government done with all that excess money? And many people have gotten very upset to find out that the answer is that it's all been spent on other things. About $1.4 trillion of Social Security and Medicare surpluses. It's all been spent elsewhere by the US Treasury. Let's see why this is. Many people are upset because they think the government should have saved the money for the future, and often they are misled to believe that this has actually happened through the existence of what are known as the Social Security and Medicare Trusts, and sometimes even a snazzier name is used, the name of lockbox. In what form could the government save the money? Perhaps they could have saved the excess money by keeping it as US dollars or depositing it in a bank. Or perhaps they could have saved the excess by investing it in the private sector. Or perhaps they could save the excess by buying government bonds. But they already are the government, so this just means writing IOUs from the government to the government. Let's look at the first possibility. If the government keeps the money as US dollars, this is tantamount to the Treasury intervening in monetary policy, which is the job of the Federal Reserve. The US Treasury would essentially be holding large sums of money out of the economy for many years, which wouldn't make sense at all. The Treasury could instead decide to deposit the savings in a bank, thereby making the funds available for use in the economy, and draw on its deposits later as benefits fall due. But the banking system is backed up by the government itself, so the promises of the bank to make good on depositors' funds is ultimately the promise of the government to itself. So why bother with all the banking fees? It makes more sense for the government just to scribble a little note to itself saying, "I owe me X trillions of dollars," which is essentially what it does. A similar argument applies to investing the Social Security and Medicare excess funds in the non-government guaranteed private sector. The private sector depends for its success on the stability and financial security of the state. If the state collapses, so does the private enterprise defined by the rules of the state. If certain private enterprises collapse, it shouldn't affect the state at all, unless there is a massive widespread collapse, and then the state would step in and provide as many guarantees as possible. So some ultimate risks are still borne by the state. But the main point of this discussion is that investing in the private sector carries with it higher risk than holding a government obligation. And the main point of Social Security is to pass risk from those that can least bear it over to those that can most bear it. Private investing without government guarantees completely removes this important risk transfer feature of Social Security and Medicare and places private sector investment risks onto those who can least afford it. Therefore, as nonsensical as it sounds, so long as there is a surplus collection of the FICA taxes, the most sensible thing to do is for the Social Security and Medicare funds to pass over the excess funds to the Treasury for the Treasury to spend back into the economy. The Treasury then writes an IOU to the trust fund to pay back the amount it just spent on something else. Basically, the government is writing an IOU to itself. The government is writing out some little pieces of paper that say, "Dear me, I owe me some money." And then they put the paper in a box, lock it up, and call it a safety lockbox or trust fund. Whether intended or not, what effectively happened to the Social Security and Medicare surpluses generated by the Reagan-era FICA tax increases and corresponding decreases in benefits was that they helped fund Reagan's military build-up of the 80s. Recently, the Bush tax cut has compounded this trend of borrowing from Social Security to fund general revenues and to lower borrowing from the private sector. Only time will tell if these promises will be broken. But in the meantime, it is important that people understand the real funding issues and not get distracted by the trust fund or lockbox accounting wizardry of the government writing IOUs to itself. Central to understanding the Social Security and Medicare dilemma is understanding what it means for the government to write an IOU to itself. As discussed, a US government IOU is the lowest risk asset, but the government being able to come good on this obligation ultimately depends on its ability to collect taxes in the future to pay off all these IOUs. In reality, looking right through the wizardry of all these IOUs from the government to the government in the so-called lockbox or trust fund, what really happens with Social Security funding is that the current base of taxpayers always fund the benefits for the current set of retirees. Social Security and Medicare are, as we say in the pension and insurance world, funded on a pay-as-you-go basis. This means that the obligations to be met this year will be funded by revenues collected this same year. There is no pre-funding of benefits, and there cannot be, as we have just argued. When it comes to being the imperial government, there is nothing safer to invest in than yourself, and this is equivalent to depending on future tax revenues to meet all future expenses, which means you fund everything on a pay-as-you-go basis. That is, again, taxes collected from current workers always pay for the benefits of current retirees. In reality, the lockbox or trust funds provide a mechanism whereby future general income tax revenues of the government may be legally transferred to meet Social Security obligations in excess of Social Security and Medicare taxes if and when needed. It is a legal mechanism to facilitate possible future flow of funds and nothing more. But there is no guarantee on benefits, and current benefits are always set by the law of the land of the day. But now we get to the problem of the liability being with the government. And that is, of course, that the government sets the law of the land. And so the government can change the laws that specify benefits if it so decides. Since the elusive lockbox or trust fund, stuffed full of government promises to itself, is little more than a legal technicality that doesn't get at the real issues of Social Security and Medicare, it should not be the focal point of discussion. However, unfortunately, some of the leaders at the US Treasury seem to think that it should be. Following is a short speech made by Treasury Secretary Wizard O'Neill at a March meeting after the release of the 2002 Social Security and Medicare Trust Fund reports.
Hi, good afternoon. Today, the Boards of Trustees of the Medicare and Social Security Trust Funds met to complete our annual review of the financial status of the trust funds and to forward the reports to Congress. Beyond the statistics and actuarial tables, the clear message from the trustees is that Social Security and Medicare need to be reformed and strengthened at the earliest opportunity. The long-term financing gap for Social Security and Medicare is larger this year than it was projected to be last year. Absent reform, over 15% of gross domestic product, nearly one out of every $6 in the economy, will be devoted to these programs by 2076. The earlier that action is taken to address this prospect, the easier it will be to strengthen these essential programs for generations to come. The projected near-term financial conditions of the trust funds have improved slightly since last year's reports, due mainly to assumed additional growth in underlying economic productivity. This reprieve provides little comfort, as the programs continue to face substantial financial challenges in the not-too-distant future that need to be addressed at the earliest opportunity. The longer we wait, the more difficult our choices will be in the future. We must take action to ensure Social Security is safe and secure for this generation and for future generations. This past fall, the President's Social Security Commission released its final report that showed how personal accounts can be an important part of the solution to strengthening Social Security. We must work now to preserve and protect Social Security so we keep our commitment to current seniors and meet the needs of our children and grandchildren.
Now I'd like to play the words of one of the other trustees of the Social Security and Medicare funds, whose name is Tom Saving. He also spoke at this press conference, but in his speech, he really got at the heart of the issues of funding future Social Security and Medicare benefits.
Now, good afternoon. I'm Tom Saving from Texas A&M University, and I'm one of the public trustees. I'm going to begin by saying in less than a decade, the combined Social Security and Medicare programs will go from providing net revenue to the Treasury to requiring a revenue transfer. Even though this year's trustees report, and that's been brought out here clearly, shows slightly better short-term news coupled with slightly worse long-term news, from the perspective of the total federal budget, these programs will impose significant costs even in the near term. Thus, even though the first trust fund exhaustion date is now 3 years later for Social Security and 1 year later for Medicare HI, the demands on the rest of the budget will begin in just a few years. This total budget perspective is important because though Social Security and Medicare HI have trust funds, when revenues into the combined system fall below expenditures, real resources must come from somewhere else in the federal budget. The bad news is that after 2004, and that's just 2 years from now, this net surplus will begin an accelerating decline. By 2010, just 8 years from now, the 2004 contribution of 3% of total income tax receipts to the U.S. Treasury will turn into a deficit. Thus, rather than providing funds to add to federal income tax revenues, these programs in 2010 will require a transfer from these same income tax receipts and begin to impinge on other federal programs. Moreover, the magnitude of the required transfer from federal income tax receipts will grow rapidly, so that by 2015, and that's 2 years before the Social Security turns into a deficit, more than 6.5% of all federal income tax receipts will have to be transferred to meet these programs. But the problem doesn't stop there, because the required transfers will continue to grow rapidly. As these numbers indicate, the total budget perspective is important. The trade-off is between doing something now or suffering the consequences later. Without significant reforms, these programs are not sustainable, but more importantly, they'll begin to impose significant costs on the Treasury as early as 2010. Thank you.
And finally, we're going to hear from a caller who called into a show that Tom Saving was on C-SPAN just after the release of the Social Security and Medicare Trust Fund reports in March of 2002. And this caller gets things pretty much right in his analysis.
Lynchburg, Virginia, up next. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Do you have a question?
No, actually, I just have a comment. It is amazing to me just how ignorant of the people that are calling in they are of this system. They actually keep talking about the dollars you get. You know, as you just explained, you don't get dollars. You get IOUs that are actually going to have to be bought back out later with tax money. You know, they seem to think that the president just sends them over. They don't realize that Congress has controlled this, and actually they've been using what you would call Medicare, Medicaid money for, you know, 30 years. They were using it for the Vietnam War. Part of the reason I think they set the trust fund up was so they could use it and claim it was a trust fund. There is no trust fund. All of this is going to have to be, all of these IOUs are going to have to be brought out and paid for again later.
If we're going to get to the heart of these issues, we may surmise that the real Social Security and Medicare funding dilemma is this. How do you fund the medical and retirement costs of an aging society and still keep being the great empire. As noted, in a pay-as-you-go system, the current base of workers always fund the current retirees and the sick. Translated into real goods and services, this means that the current base of workers produce all the goods and services not only for themselves, but also for an increasing proportion of non-producers. The demographic trends driving an increasing ratio of non-workers needing support to supporting workers are, first, medical advances that mean that people live longer, are retired longer, and have higher medical expenses. Second, of course, is lower fertility rates, keeping down the supply of new workers. And third is the impending retirement of the large baby boomer generation. In the coming years, more and more of society's resources will be going towards supporting retirees and increasing medical expenses for society as a whole. This will be true whether benefits are funded in the public sector or the private sector or both. Thus, private savings accounts and privatizing Social Security cannot solve the problem, and discussion of these as a solution should also not be allowed to distract debate from the real issues. In fact, putting current contributions into private accounts will make the current funding situation much worse, because the funds are now used to pay for current retirees and not to save for the future. This increasing demand on society's resources creates great pressure on funds that might otherwise go towards empire building and maintenance, namely military and economic infrastructure spending, and will likely lead to much slower economic growth. This is perhaps the real dilemma that keeps the emperors and their friends up at night. Since many necessary empire maintenance and building expenditures originate in the public sector, there is a very real danger that a good chunk of the publicly funded safety net could be cut in the coming decades. Economic risks are thus passed back to those who can least afford them. There is a very real concern that increasing total medical and pension costs will lead to an even worse situation of services being provided on an ability to pay rather than a needs basis. While it is true that both labour force productivity gains and further government borrowing from outside the government could serve to meet some of these increasing obligations, it is not clear that these could be sufficient to solve the problem, and both of these can come with nasty side effects. The point to be made here is that people need to be aware of what the real trade-offs are, and that public discussion should be about the real issues and not about some mythical trust fund or lockbox, as is so often done by the government spin doctors. Furthermore, even more dire a situation than the Social Security dilemma is the increasing share of national expenditure devoted to health care, as alluded to earlier. This affects all of Medicare funding, Medicaid funding, private medical funding, and the ability of society to come up with a solution to the uninsured problem in the midst of exploding healthcare costs everywhere else. And then add to all this the riskiness of national output or GDP itself, with more and more of it being conceptual and abstract services and thus able to disappear from the economy just as surely as Enron disintegrated. Recall that in the last episode of Wizards, Wizards Part 11, we included some words of caution from the great wizard Greenspan about the risk of the components of GDP becoming increasingly conceptual. The final sting of the dilemma is this. If people were content for the projected increase in healthcare and retirement to eat into empire building and maintenance expenses, then, of course, the empire itself is at risk. And when the empire is at risk, so is the whole financial and economic system through which these benefits are paid anyway. So there are no easy answers, except maybe, perhaps a new religion is in order.
And so the king is once again my guest. And why is this? Was Herod unimpressed?
Return to Rome to sentence Nazareth. We have no law to put a man to death.
In the deteriorating years of its empire, Rome, ever practical, saw fit to rejuvenate its imperial power using the cheapest and most efficient tactic, a new religion to rally the troops around. Though the ruling emperors and governors wouldn't have known at the time, Rome's business-as-usual termination of a messiah provided tremendous returns 300 years later as the empire was collapsing. After all, if you don't have money to pay soldiers, you can always rally them around a new and appealing religion, for free. In a few years or decades or centuries, the American Empire might also try its way out of its dwindling empire dilemma with a shot at a new religion. Apparently, the existing dominant religion so beneficial to, and kindly handed down from, the Romans themselves isn't working too well and only makes the longevity quest even worse. It seems that all the fire and brimstone warnings have really sunk in and everyone wants to delay as long as possible the taking of the inevitable perpetual nap. Perhaps a new religion could help alleviate this cultural trend to want to live in one's earthly body well beyond what nature had intended for it. Inventing some religious worship methods that involve physical exercise would be an added bonus. The possibilities are endless. In any case, as silly as it sounds, such tactics would probably work much better than a mythical lock box. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 12. Note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.